Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. In the second half of the program today, Lee Austin's guest is Cheryl Wudan, co-author of Half the Sky, Turning Oppression into Opportunity for Women Worldwide, a New York Times bestselling book. Cheryl Wudan is a Pulitzer Prize winner. Lee Austin had a chance to speak with her when Cheryl Wudan was on the campus of Utah State University earlier in the week. My guest, live program in the first half of the program, is Yaroslav Folda. He's a medievalist. He studies the art of medieval world, and his book is Crusader Art in the Holy Land, the Third Crusade to the Fall of Acre. He's on the campus of Utah State University to give the International Center for Medieval Arts Harvey Stahl Memorial Lecture, and he's my guest in the first half of the program. First up is the news.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Lee Austin is in the second half with an interview with the Pulitzer Prize winner Cheryl Wudan, co-author of Half the Sky. And my guest in the first half of the program is Yaroslav Folda, who's a professor of the history of art at the University of North Carolina. His area of interest for teaching and research is the art of the High Middle Ages in Europe, the Mediterranean world. His area of study includes medieval manuscript illumination, medieval icon and panel painting, and medieval sculpture from the 11th century to the 15th century, the art of crusaders as well in the Holy Land. He's on the campus of Utah State University for various events. The public lecture is 5 o'clock this afternoon in Merrill Kazir Library Room 101, and it's titled The Church of the Holy Sepulchre and the Christian Multiculturalism in the Levant. And Professor Folda, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here. Particularly glad to see it snowing.
Yeah, yes, we could really use it.
We don't see it in Chapel Hill.
I wouldn't imagine.
Very often, anyway.
It causes some travel difficulties, but we're grateful for it today. It's been a very dry winter for us. So the history of art, this is art and its history and how they combine. This is obviously of an interest of yours. Tell us how you got into that.
Right. Well, I think the crucial thing was that when I was about 13, 14, my dad, who was in the career service officer in the Army, was stationed in Germany, southern Germany, and then in Paris, France, for 2 years. And we had this sort of family tradition where every Sunday we would go out visiting local interesting monuments, churches, castles, things like that. And when we got to Paris, of course, it was amazing because every Sunday we could go to church in a different medieval church, like the Sainte-Chapelle or Notre Dame or Saint-Germain-des-Prés, Saint-Sulpice, Saint-Eustache. I mean, it was amazing. And you know, at age 13, I was just experiencing it. And then we went back to the United States, and When I finally decided to go to college, in my junior year, I got into a class with a German professor named Kurt Weitzmann, who all of a sudden was teaching us about these works of medieval art, and I discovered that there was so much to learn about them in an intellectual sense. And it was fantastic. I mean, it was just like the light came on and suddenly I was doing the history of art, which was a field that I basically didn't know anything about until I was a sophomore at Princeton, and then I took his course in my junior year. So then I got to graduate school with the help of Professor Weitzmann. I went to Johns Hopkins and studied with another wonderful German professor who had specialized on the sculpture of Chartres Cathedral and had written this fantastic book, really fantastic book. And he was my sort of inspiration for doing the scholarship that I got started on, but he died on the second year. So I then was working in the Walters Art Museum in Baltimore for a wonderful woman who was in charge of all the illustrated manuscripts in their collection. The Walters has the second largest illuminated manuscript collection in the United States. Well, I think it's still second, after the Morgan Library in New York, and along with the Getty in California. And lo and behold, I discovered in there a pair of manuscripts which were illustrated chronicles of the history of the Crusades, which actually the history of the Crusader states, the history of what was going on in the Latin East during this 200-year period. And I got really interested in that. And that's where my interest to sort of study the Crusader art really started, about 1965 or so.
Mm-hmm. So, and you've studied the Crusades. It's interesting, there's an intersection here, right? The history and art. And art can tell us about history. History can tell us about art.
That's right. Well, actually, how I got into this is partly also because when I was in Paris, I had this amazing, wonderful professor, Professor Harvey was his name, who taught world history. And he treated us as sophomores, juniors, whatever, as if we were college students. And he wanted us to learn how to write critically. He wanted us to learn how to think clearly. He wanted us to analyze and make sense out of what we were reading. And he wanted us to write our resulting ideas about it in coherent narrative prose. And he was a stickler for this, and wonderful. I mean, it was a challenge. Like, when we first got into this class, about the second or third class, he casually dropped a question one day about, well, I wonder what books you have in your private libraries. You know, all of us students were looking around and saying, private library? What private library? So we decided we'd better get with it and start making one, which was easy in Paris because we could take a trip over to London where the books were super cheap. And this was in 1953, 1954. And, you know, get started with some of the great books, but in our own personal library. And because of his inspiration in history, then when I got to college, I was taking all these history courses. And actually, I applied at first to graduate school in history because I really hadn't fully understood that you could make a life in the history of art as a career. But when I took that course that I told you about with Professor Weitzman, and I talked to him about it, and he advised me to talk to other people, then I realized, and he helped me get into graduate school in art history. But the history is absolutely fundamental, and it was absolutely wonderful to have the foundation of the history before moving in. I mean, I would almost recommend that a student would study history in college either before they took their art history or while they were taking the art history. I mean, it's just so essential to supply the context. And for the Crusades, it was really crucial because in those days, nobody knew much about Crusader art. It was a new field, started really in 1957. And so we had to sort of get started. And the way to start was to fully learn about the Crusades, about what the Crusaders did when they were in the Holy Land and what happened to them. And then we started to try to assemble the works of art. And that's what that book you mentioned that I did, that's one of two books where I tried to do exactly that. Mm-hmm. I tried to take the historical panorama, the historical circumstances, and to use those circumstances to help me find works of art, things that are mentioned in the chronicles but, you know, may have disappeared, or we learn about the buildings, or we learn about some sculptural program or something like that. So that's sort of how it worked. But the history was absolutely absolutely basic to it. And one of the beautiful things has been that some of my closest colleagues during my sort of research from 1970 till 2005 or what, have been Crusader historians because they're interested in the art from their vantage point of being a historian. But happily, they see me and others working in the kind of work I do to supply them with works of art which are more fully explained, so that they can draw on them and and use them for their work and their thinking.
I wonder if you could give us an example, just one example of you know, a piece of art, and how that helps us understand the history, and vice versa.
Right. Well, there are so many works like that, but the things I've been working on most recently have been icon painting, and the icon paintings that are where it's possible to associate Crusader. We call them Crusader artists, but they're artists who were probably trained by Byzantine painters, but they were resident in the Holy Land during the time the Crusaders were there between 1098 and 1291. So at a certain point, these artists began to be interested in creating icons that looked like Byzantine icons. And right now, I mean, I'm just trying to understand how this is going on, because we have about 130 Crusader icons that we've corporately been able to identify. And these are icons that look very much like Byzantine icons, but they have certain Western features in them. Like, take for example the Virgin and Child, a typical devotional image that the Byzantines painted. Well, there's a sort of a strict formula for the way the Byzantines do this. The Virgin is holding this child in a very ritualistic way. The child looks like a sort of a little man, and he's blessing and holding a scroll. He looks like a miniature ruler. But when the Crusader artists, when these Western artists, Western-influenced artists, start painting that icon, they change the whole relationship. They retain the Byzantine look with the garments, what they're sitting on, and the poses and all that. But they change the relationship between the mother and the child, so that now perhaps particularly the child becomes a baby and is much more rambunctious, and maybe he's reaching out to grab his mother's veil, or he's holding her hand or something. I mean, none of that goes on in a Byzantine icon. I mean, this is a formal cultic image. With the Crusaders, this all of a sudden is infused with a really wonderful human dimension, which probably reflects the fact that most of those Crusader artists had some kind of Italian background. They were coming from Italian families, or they were even maybe started out being trained in central Italy somewhere, Pisa, Siena, Florence, someplace like that. And then they came out to the Holy Land for maybe on pilgrimage. Mm. And then they started to paint these things. Mm. Well, these icons can definitely show us the interrelationship between the Byzantines and the Crusaders as they interacted in a part of the Near East where the Crusaders were dominant. And of course, there were other parts of the Near East where the Byzantines were dominant. So there's a dialogue set up. It changes. Things happen. And the Crusaders take this over. And then the part that I'm studying right now is, what was the impact of those icons and maybe those artists on the Central Italian West, especially the Central Italian West? I mean, Pisa, Lucca, Siena, Florence. Those were the cities which were most commercially linked to the Near East, and through which cultural ideas, especially ideas about the art, were coming in. And suddenly, I mean, really suddenly, around 1260, all of a sudden we see a tremendous popularization of a certain kind of image of the Virgin and Child enthroned with angels, which is completely un-Byzantine, but is totally, I think, possibly a Crusader invention. And it then becomes it becomes widespread in Italy, and it's at a very, very crucial historical moment. The historical moment in the East is that's when the Byzantines were able to retake Constantinople. The Crusaders had taken Constantinople in 1204, but the Byzantines were now able to get their act together and come back and take it back in 1261. At the same time in the West, various things are happening, and one of the things that happens is that Siena defeats Florence in this momentous battle called the Battle of Montaperti. And since Siena was dedicated to the Virgin, suddenly everybody in Siena, all the religious orders, I mean, you know, like the Servites, the Benedictines, the Dominicans, the Franciscans, everybody wanted to have a cult image. And apparently they wanted a cult image that looked like these Crusader images from the East, and that's what I'm trying to sort out. But that's and we have to find out about the history in order to give us shed light on just why this was happening, because it's so dramatically, all of a sudden, popularization of this very particular kind of cult image. And these, I mean, I'm telling you, these are expensive. These are huge. They're over life size. They're altarpieces that are, and I mean, one of the important things for me is that they're covered in not only gold backgrounds, so there's a massive amount of gold causing a lot of expense. The draperies of the figures are also covered with golden highlighting, what we call golden highlighting. This golden divine, what appears to be divine light, not natural light, but divine light, gold all over the draperies. And I'm trying to understand the word for it is chrysography, writing in gold. But this writing is the golden highlighting on those draperies. And it's very exciting. So that's what I'm working on. And in fact, I'm going to give a different lecture for an individual course that addresses this sort of issue right now.
If you just joined us, we're talking with Yaroslav Folda, who's a professor of the history of art at University of North Carolina. And he's giving the International Center for Medieval Arts Harvey Stahl Memorial Lecture at 5 o'clock this afternoon. That's a public lecture. You're invited. That's co-sponsored by the Kane College of the Arts and the Program in Religious Studies at Utah State University. It's called The Church of the Holy Sepulchre and Christian Multiculturalism in the Levant. It's in the Merrill Kazir Library, room 101 on the Utah State University campus. We have another 5 minutes left in this conversation. You're welcome to join it at 1-800-826-1495 if you would like to. Again, that lecture is Merrill Kazir Library, room 101 on the USU campus. Yaroslav Folda, my guest. I wonder if you, because the time period that you study is a clash of cultures, and it's a long term. That's sometimes we forget about the Crusades. There are various battles, but it's a long term interaction of cultures that's happening today as well. And I don't know if you ever bring those lessons forward to either the art or the history that's happening today.
Right. Well, as a matter of fact, I think we all saw that unfortunate moment after 9/11 when the president was busy talking about the Crusade situation. And This was an unhappy idea because the content of understanding who the Crusaders were and also who the Crusaders were, who their adversaries were, has completely changed. So it's of course, as everybody knows who's listening to this, we use the word crusade all the time. I mean, people, you know, Billy Graham goes on a crusade, this and that, and Eisenhower wrote Crusade in Europe. I mean, this is all a kind of a shorthand in which some vague parallel is drawn between the Crusades, which the Crusades were a very specific phenomenon in which people made a vow to do penance and to go and liberate the Holy Land from the Muslims, which at the time, the Muslims in those days were the Fatimids, and then later the Ayyubids, and later the Mamluks, and so forth. But your first part of your question is absolutely right. I mean, the clash of cultures that we saw then, certainly we see it in a completely different, I mean, I want to emphasize how different I think the situations are in right now as compared to then. But then, I mean, wow, the clash of cultures was amazing. And in the 13th century, there was this sort of astonishing kind of world dimension to all this, because the Crusaders were all coming from European West, and they were settling in along the coast of Syria, Palestine. The Byzantines were out there with their empire, which had been longstanding since Constantine had founded Constantinople in the 4th century, and so they were positioned against these differing Muslim entities. And it was possible from time to time for the Muslims to sort of unify, and that's what was the downfall of the Crusaders. But there were also other amazing cultures involved here. One was the Turks. The Turks in Anatolia, the Seljuk Turks, and a little farther east. But in particular, in the 13th century, we have the Mongols. The Mongols enter this zone, and when they take Baghdad and say 1258, and then they move east and take Damascus, suddenly the Mongols looked like they were going to steamroll both the Crusaders, and it was only with the death of one of the major Mongol rulers, one of the Khans in the Far East, that they pulled back. And so the Mongols become a real factor. And one of the interesting things about the Mongols was, just at that time, around the 1250s, 1260s, they had not, so to speak, made a decision about what religion they would be, the Mongols. They were considering, different tribes of the Mongols were considering different religions. But there were Nestorian Christians among the Mongols, and the Western rulers, when they learned this, started to send, like King Louis IX of France, started sending missionaries out to see if they couldn't make some kind of an alliance with the Mongols. The idea about this was possibly there would be the chance for Christianity to genuinely become the major world religion. Unfortunately, that didn't happen. The Mongols and the Crusaders and even the Pope and various kings of Western Europe kind of missed the chance to make this alliance. And so at the end of the 13th century, the Mongols converted to Islam.
The history would have been very different.
That's the whole idea, yeah.
Oh, leave it there. We're out of time. But the lecture will be very interesting. That's coming up at 5 o'clock this afternoon in USU, Merrill Kazir Library Room 101. It's given by University of North Carolina History of Art Professor Yaroslav Folda, and it's titled The Church of the Holy Sepulchre and Christian Multiculturalism in the Levant. And that is the International Center for Medieval Arts Harvey Stahl Memorial Lecture. Professor Folda, thanks for coming in.
So nice to be here. Thank you.
Coming up following a brief break, Lee Austin's conversation from earlier this week with Cheryl Woudun, Pulitzer Prize-winning co-author of Half the Sky. That's coming up.
I'm Mackenzie Hamilton, and I'd like to invite you to join me and Tom Williams for Evening News at 5:30, new in 2012. A new view with daily reports from Moab, St. George, Cedar City, Vernal, Salt Lake City, Brigham City, and Cache Valley, with the latest weather and air quality conditions from the Utah Climate Center. New for You News, weekday evenings at 5:30 on Utah Public Radio, your favorite public radio station for expanded Utah news.
Support for Utah Public Radio comes from Square One Printing in Logan, with personalized printing for home or business, including directories, booklets, marketing pieces, posters, and employee or owner's manuals. Information at squareoneprinting.com.
Listening to Access Utah, I'm Lee Austin, filling in this morning for Tom Williams, and we are very pleased to have a very special guest with us in the first portion of the program. Cheryl Woudun is the co-author of the best-selling book Half the Sky, Turning Oppression into Opportunity for Women Worldwide, written with her husband Nicholas Kristof. The two have reported extensively from China and for the New York Times received a Pulitzer Prize. And she is at Utah State University giving a presentation and is sponsored here by the Center for Women and Gender and the Office of Executive Vice President and Provost, and our thanks to them for making some time available. Cheryl Woudun, thank you very much for coming in.
Lee, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
The book, as the title suggests, is about oppression of women, something you've even called gendercide. Serious violence, slavery, sex trafficking, maternal women disappearing, basically, in China. And yet you also offer examples of situations that start out very badly and offer hope.
Absolutely. The book really is a culmination of a lot of research and reporting and thought over the many years that we've been reporting. We didn't set out to write this book. We actually the book evolved after we thought about some of the trends that we were seeing in the different places that we had reported. I'd say that the idea, if I look back now, the seeds of the idea really were sown in China. We had been reporting about China and specifically about the Tiananmen Square. Right, and a lot of people were killed there, and it was a terrible thing to have happened. Maybe 500 to 800 people, we estimate, were killed on Tiananmen Square. The New York Times ran front-page stories day after day.
Some of which you had written.
Of course, yes. And then the next year, we started roaming the countryside, and we saw some things there that were so horrific, and not one word had been written about them. And what that was at the heart of it, was that there were about 39,000 baby girls missing or dying every year. They were not in the statistics. And if you gross that up, as demographers did, that amounted to about 30 million missing female babies in China over the years. And, of course, some of that is due to underreporting because of China's one-child policy, which made people think, oh, we should, want to have a boy. And others were the result of, abortion, because when the potential mother sees that it's a baby girl and she wants a boy and she only has one shot, she gets an abortion. And the others are, there were occasions of infanticide, unfortunately. So that was where it started.
So again, mention that number, the incredible number of
missing girls in China. And at the time we thought this was we thought it was just China. China is a very vast, very complicated country. And we thought, well, it's China. And then we moved to Japan and we were covering Asia for the New York Times. And although we wrote many, many different stories about the economy, about politics, the Asian financial crisis, a number of things, one of the things that we had reported on occasionally that really stuck out in our mind was some of the issues facing women. My husband had gone down to Cambodia when we were living in Japan, and he had learned about the sex trade there and saw some terrible things in basically sex trafficking. And that's where he first got exposed to what is now sex trafficking, sex slavery.
Actually, you prefer the term slavery.
Yes, I do talk about that in the book, and I explain that, you know, if you actually look at what happens to a girl, I mean, sometimes she's 13, 14 years old, and she's actually kidnapped and then basically forced to work against her will and not paid anything. That's really slavery. So as we reporting in Asia, we saw that this was happening. There was a lot of discrimination in Asia at times, discrimination to death. But we thought that was Asia. We just thought that was Asia. And then we moved back to the States, and my husband then became a columnist for the New York Times, and he started traveling throughout Africa. And we saw a lot of practices that were very disfavorable towards women in Africa. And so over the years, we started trying to pull these threads together. And, you know, we did a lot of research, and the result is half the sky.
And that comes from a Chinese proverb, by the way, the title.
It does. It comes from something that Mao Zedong once said, once popularized, called "Women Hold Up Half the Sky." And, you know, for all, he had his own certain intentions for trying to bring women in. And part of it was that he saw an untapped resource. He saw half the population in China wasn't working, so let's get them to work so we can, you know, boost the economy. And the result was that women were working, which at the time, you know, they were truck drivers too. But in the end, the result is that it was the best thing that happened to China, because then women actually were brought into the formal labor force, and they were thought of as people who could work, just like, you know, men. And so that was carried out through to the current times. And women now, I mean, China's a big place. It's very complicated. But by and large, for a developing country, although, you know, it's gotten really far up the ladder, I'm not sure you can still call it a developing country, but it's done very, very well by its women.
And they've ended the practice of foot binding.
Oh, absolutely. And thank goodness for that.
I mean, some practices can be changed.
Absolutely. And that gives me very much hope for other practices in places, for instance, in Africa, in particular, female cutting. I mean, I think there is real hope. People say, oh, don't touch the culture. This is something that we shouldn't do as an outsider. But I actually have seen, not with my own eyes, because this happened, you know, a century ago in China, the foot binding was eradicated with foreign and outside help. And it can be done, but it has to be done correctly. In other words, if outsiders want to help, they really do need to work with local partners, because it's the local people who really need to bring about the change. But they could certainly use advice, expertise, support, all sorts of things that foreigners can bring.
The very last chapter, there's four things that the readers can do right now to help, and I'm going to make a point of getting to that before we run out of time. Cheryl Woodun is our guest and co-author of Half the Sky, the book that we're talking about. There are parallels to slavery as the U.S. experienced it in the 19th century and slavery today. The numbers are pretty staggering compared to the Africans who were taken to the New World from Africa versus any of the varying numbers today.
Right, right. And as I say in my talk at the university, it really is something akin to slavery. You know, if you just look, you know, people like statistics, they like numbers because it helps them believe. But, you know, first of all, I do want to say that in practice, you know, in terms of the psychological mind, it is very, very similar. It is slavery. And in times it's torture, too, because these women are beaten up. So it's a horrific thing. But in terms of numbers, if you look at the peak of the slave trade in the 1770s, 1780s, there were maybe 80,000 slaves brought from Africa to the New World each year. You know, it's 80,000. And nowadays, it's much harder to get a handle on it because we have, you know, all borders all over the world. And it's very hard to get a handle on the numbers of people going across international borders. But the State Department has very, very rough estimates that it's 800,000. And that's just international borders. So there's a lot of intra-trafficking that goes on that wouldn't even hit the statistics because they're internal. So, for instance, anything that goes on within the U.S., and there is trafficking in the U.S., but also in Cambodia. A lot of what we've saw in Cambodia was intra within Cambodia. Never would have hit that statistics. So some people, when they try and add up all of them, the numbers get very large.
Opening part of the book does deal with the situation of girls being forced into prostitution. In fact, in the introduction, you introduce us to the first of these many individual faces.
Oh, absolutely. We talk about stories. This is the way we actually know that this is happening, because we've talked to girls who are so young who have been kidnapped and forced to work in brothels 7 days a week. And, you know, we actually meet them and we see what happens to them when they escape, the kind of beatings that they get and the scars that they have and some of the terrible things that have happened to them. But we also have seen remarkably heroic women who and men who also have said, this is enough and we're going to help. And often it's people in those particular areas and they see it around them and they want to bring about change. And so they set up a clinic or they are raising money to help bring about change. They're doing remarkable things, all at risk to themselves.
And by the way, you have, in most cases, photographs of these girls and women that you write about, those who have overcome the odds and successfully been able to deal with a very bad hand.
We do have some photographs. Not everybody wanted to have their photograph in the book, but we do have some photographs. It's kind of scary, you know, what happens to them. What I'm very cheered about is that there is a lot of work being done. And the fact that there's greater attention here in the U.S. Has really helped, because there is not only greater awareness about the problems, it being existing in the rest of the world, but also here in the U.S., and that there's greater awareness that Americans can help and outsiders can help. It's not as though we should feel powerless that, oh, that's something that happens out there. The other thing is that it may happen out there, but because we are in a global world, you know, things actually move very fast. So what's remarkable is that when we started reporting on this, sex trafficking was something that happened only in Cambodia but it happened far away in a developing world. But, you know, in the years that we've been covering this issue, and my husband in particular has been covering this, it's actually grown here in the U.S. too. So it is in our backyard. Things, practices travel fast.
Let's put a name to a story, one of the girls in the book that you write about.
Well, one of the girls that, you know, we also salute quite a bit is Somali Mom. She was kidnapped herself and then forced to work in a brothel. She got very lucky because she became very close to a couple of her clients who were foreigners, and they brought her out and married her. One of them married her. And she got very lucky. But instead of, you know, running off to France, where her husband was from, she decided, nope, I'm going to come back to my home place and I am going to set up a clinic and I'm going to help other women escape from the clinic. So she did that, and now she's been raising funds in the U.S. She has a really good presence here in the U.S. She has hired, you know, Americans to help her work here. And about a year and a half ago, almost 2 years ago, Mayor Bloomberg, the mayor of New York City, announced a campaign against sex trafficking in conjunction with Somali Mom. So how remarkable it is that a former brothel slave is helping advise New York City on how to end its or how to fight against sex trafficking. That's pretty remarkable.
You and your husband purchased freedom.
My husband did. Yes, my husband did, actually. And this is not something that we want anybody to do, but it was a way to see how it all works. And he did purchase two slaves in Cambodia. for very little money, and he then tried to set them free. But what we learned is that it's not very easy to do that. You cannot just set them free like birds and they'll fly away. It's very, very complicated. So one of them he brought back to her hometown, and she was able to settle, and you know, there were some hardships in adjusting, but she was able to start her own business with some funds that an NGO put up for her to help her adjust, because it was a very difficult adjustment. And she had trauma after what she had gone through. The second woman, though, after being brought back to her hometown, ran back to the brothel because she was addicted to drugs they had given her. So it's really difficult.
In some cases, earlier we were talking about the successful effort to end foot binding, and another current terrible situation with cutting, that one must be careful how they try to correct these situations, which in part may be cultural practices. But in the case of sexual slavery, you suggest a big stick approach.
Oh, as opposed to legalization, is that what you mean? Yes. No, I think that, look, every situation is very, very different. Every country is very, very different. So there's no hard and fast rule. But if you do look at some of the experiences that we've seen in, for instance, Sweden versus Amsterdam, there were different approaches taken there. Sweden took the hard stick approach and focused on the Johns, and Amsterdam legalized it and said, you know, we want to bring everything above board so that we can monitor them more successfully. Well, it's clear that Sweden's model was much more successful, and Amsterdam still has a very, very big problem. We've seen elsewhere in India, there's also a program there where they tried legalization, but there was a little bit of a deception there in terms of the results. They portrayed results that were really not the real results, and so they were, you know, they were praised for results that were false, that we believe were false. And so we do think, on the other hand, there were other places in India where it's outright banned and just illegal, and things have cleaned up there.
Let's talk a little bit about the area of gender violence, and this would include really horrific examples. There was a piece on NPR the other day about acid throwing in Pakistan, and then you've got honor killings and a whole category of really terrible acts.
Yes, no, that absolutely, it does occur, unfortunately. I think it is on the decline, which is great, but the fact that it still exists in this day and age is pretty remarkable. And I think that it does have to be eradicated, and I think that foreign pressure can help. And with foreign support and that is working with local partners to really educate people, to show them this is not the way to treat people, then that it should be a crime, that's really important. It's not, we've not gotten to that state yet, but I think that it really, if you say that it's a crime to throw acid on someone's face, then and if it's implemented, if police will implement it, then you can bring about change. It's not a cultural thing. I mean, that's just ridiculous. Acid was never something cultural that existed over the hundreds of years. It's been a recent phenomenon that people have had access to acid. So
why does that happen? What is a typical circumstance?
Well, I think that they it's just that they think often in the situation where they think the woman is at fault, and sometimes it's for something that is in this country would, you know, not even be a crime. It's not a crime. It's not illegal in this country at all. It's just something that they may, not do right. Maybe they embarrass the family or something like that, but they can throw acid on a woman's face. It just needs, education needs to be done, and we need to, education in general will help on all fronts, including those kind of attacks.
And other things like honor killings?
Same thing. I think education really is the way to bring about long-term change and persistent change. Education of both boys and girls. Because I think that it's very important for boys to understand that girls can go to school and that girls can be just as smart as boys, and that they should have similar opportunities as well. And so when you start changing a culture through education, then those kind of things can disappear, and also supported by laws that say this is just wrong. This is, you know, this should be outlawed. Then you can bring about change. But it is obviously very hard going.
Has progress been made on maternal mortality? The situation where parents may not take their girl to see the doctor if she is sick, but of course the boy gets better attention.
There are a number of things going on here. In the case of maternal mortality, which happens more in Africa, you have a situation where there's very little access to health care. There just simply aren't clinics in the local villages. And also, it's not a practice that women who get pregnant go to see the doctor. They just think, oh, this is the normal practice. Things we've done this for centuries. We know what happens. But also what's been happening for centuries is that, you know, maybe 1 in 10 or 1 in 12 women die in childbirth, and they just think that's normal. Well, it doesn't have to be normal. And most developing countries go through this. They have, you know, high maternal mortality rates, and then as they get more educated and the standard of living rises, then this is something that goes away goes on to the decline. But we have made progress because the West has devoted a lot of funds to it. Many countries have really done a great job in trying to allocate funds to help develop healthcare clinics, and a lot of NGOs have helped out. There's been a lot of foreign West money that goes into helping bring about some maternal health care in Africa. And so the numbers have gotten much better.
And again, we're speaking with Cheryl Wudun, who co-authored with her husband Nicholas Kristof the best-selling book Half the Sky. And our thanks to Utah State University and the Center for Women and Gender and the Office of the Executive Vice President and Provost for making your appearance here possible. A few more questions before we run out of time. How much of this oppression is related to economics, to poverty?
A lot of it is related to poverty. A lot of it is related to the lack of economic opportunity. I mean, if a woman is in the position where she actually can start a business or bring in some income, that changes her economic status immediately. We saw that in many places. And, you know, if you look at China, for instance, partly because Mao had actually lifted the status of women and said they could work, that was always the foundation, you know, on which women, girls, basically, when they were allowed to get educated, and they were alongside the boys, then they could graduate middle school or even high school, potentially, and then get jobs in factories. And that was just seminal. That was really critical because that meant often a teenage girl was the first person to bring home a paycheck in a peasant family. Peasant family working in the farms, they don't bring any paychecks. They're, you know, harvesting, and they take their stuff to market and sell what they can, but there's no paycheck. She's bringing home a paycheck. So that's a real different a different status, and that elevates her status. And so if you can do that in a lot of the rest of the world, in the developing world, you really can start to bring about change in the way families perceive the role of women. Men, husbands in particular, boy, if they see a woman being able to earn money through some business that she developed because she has a small loan and you know, chooses a smart business, then, you know, he benefits.
There has been progress in some countries, others, Pakistan, not so much.
Right. In fact, there's a very interesting contrast when you look at Pakistan and Bangladesh, which at one point in time, recently in the past 30 years or 40 years, were the same country, right? And what happened was they separated. Bangladesh educated its girls and allowed them to work. And they were able to work in the textile mills, in the apparel industry. And so Bangladesh actually developed an apparel industry and exported it. Look, Bangladesh is still a developing country. It's far from perfect, but it actually did well by its women. And in fact, a lot of the women now are educated. They're in nursing. They're trying to build a nursing industry. They've just done really, really well. You have a very vibrant microfinance industry there. In contrast, if you look at Pakistan, which did not educate its girls and its women, we know the problems in Pakistan.
And the United States finds itself in the position of needing Pakistan as an ally in its war against Afghanistan, another country where the oppression is pretty serious.
Absolutely. You know, I often think that if we could have taken just like, you know, 5% of the military budget that was allocated to the Afghanistan war and invested it in schools. And we, obviously you would have to find the right parties to do this through. It's not something that soldiers can do. But if you invested in education over the past 10 years, we would have had a different we would have had a generation of well-educated youth, both boys and girls, young men and young women. And I think things would be different among that generation.
Last two questions, and these fall in the area of how to respond. Having read Half the Sky and feeling the outrage, where do we go? First, as a country, as a foreign policy.
Right. Well, I certainly think that USAID is, you know, needs to continue to take a very prominent role and should not be reduced in funding. You know, we may have problems here at home, but the USAID is so critical for bringing about change in the world, and the U.S. can really play a leading role in that. There are other countries that, as a percentage of their GDP, allocate far more to foreign aid than the U.S. does. And the U.S. is a rich country. On that front, I really think that the U.S. as a nation can continue. I mean, Secretary Clinton has done a remarkable job of promoting human rights and women's rights wherever she goes. She goes to Pakistan. She meets with Pakistani women. She's actually been to the Congo and visited the rape capital of the world, which is unbelievable. No other Secretary of State has ever done that. And that's really important. She's put it on the agenda, on the international agenda. I think she's really raised the awareness among the world, among other countries, that this is something that is important. Obviously, she's got a zillion other things to deal with, and it's not her first priority, but she has made it a priority. So I think that that's really very important.
Individually, and you do address this in the last chapter of the book, this is too huge a problem for one person to even contemplate helping.
That's why we need a movement. That's why we need everybody just to contribute a tiny amount of their time or skill or resources or expertise. And if you get so many more people involved than are involved today, you can move the needle. You can bring about change. We saw that happen with foot binding. We've seen that happen with the women's vote. Women got the vote. So many things have been brought about, been changed, partly because there's been a movement. People, it's something that people care about. But in order for them to care about something, they have to learn about it. And so that's why we're really trying to raise the awareness of this as a problem, because, you know, some of these problems are coming back to the U.S. As we mentioned earlier, sex trafficking is something that is in the U.S. right now, and it's a growing problem. So it's not something that is out there anymore. We have it in our own backyard, and so if we don't start to take steps to change it, to bring about change, then it's just going to get larger. So rather than denial, we really should, you know, confront it and just, you know, piece of your time, maybe once a week or once a month or whatever, just to get involved and sort of learn about it, how you can help. I think
a little bit of money. There are websites.
A little bit of money too. There are lots of websites in the back of the book. We have a list of 40 organizations that, you know, that are helping in so many different ways that they can get involved with or contribute to if they want. You know, there are a lot of things individuals can do.
The book is Half the Sky, Turning Oppression into Opportunity for Women Worldwide, and Cheryl Wudunn is the co-author with her husband Nicholas Kristof, a guest at Utah State University. And a final thank you to the Center for Women and Gender in the Office of Executive Vice President and Provost for making it possible. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you, Lee.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.